From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A CIA state? Today we'll look at the Central Intelligence Agency's role in the Middle East. Also, clean money for clean campaigns. Massachusetts and Arizona voters will decide on campaign finance reform next Tuesday. And Race in the Races, we'll take a look at the effort to get out the African-American vote. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Colombia's new president visits the White House today with drugs and rebels at the top of the agenda. Conservative President Andrés Pastrana meets with Clinton at a time when his country faces increasing violence on the part of paramilitary death squads, which have been increasingly linked to the Colombian military. However, both the U.S. and Colombia highlighted fighting the guerrilla movement and the drug trade as the centerpiece of their meeting, and not human rights. A new report on Colombia by Human Rights Watch condemns widespread impunity for gross human rights violators. Despite this, the U.S. has continued to provide military assistance to Colombia to fight the so-called war on drugs. Palestinian President Yasser Arafat expressed confidence today that his land for security agreement with Israel would be implemented, despite a delay in its submission to the Israeli cabinet for approval. "I think that what has been signed will be implemented accurately," he said when asked about Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's decision not to present the deal to his cabinet until he sees a Palestinian security plan. Netanyahu yesterday postponed the ratification of the Y Plantation agreements, bowing to pressure from right-wing constituents opposed to the peace accords who vowed to destroy Netanyahu's political career. This news from Jakarta. Around 8,000 students demonstrated outside Indonesia's parliament today in the largest protest against the government of dictator B.J. Habibie since he came to power 5 months ago. Students converged on parliament on foot and in buses, waving banners and chanting to mark the country's Youth Day. More than 800 armed police and troops kept most students back from the parliament grounds, although around 300 protesters evaded security and advanced right up to the gates of the parliament compound. Chileans nervously wait a ruling today from London's High Court on a motion to release ex-dictator Augusto Pinochet from arrest, with Chilean rightists threatening more protests if he's not freed. The High Court's decision on a writ of habeas corpus to free Pinochet from police custody is actually due this morning. If the judges reject the legal challenge, Chile's rightist Independent Democratic Union, a UDI opposition party, has said it and the right-wing National Renovation Party would call for nationwide protest. Britain arrested Pinochet on a request from a Spanish judge seeking to have him extradited and prosecuted on charges of genocide, torture, and terrorism during his 17-year rule that ended in 1990. He also faces extradition requests from France, Switzerland, and Sweden. AIDS is cutting the life expectancy in many African countries and will effectively reduce their populations within the next 10 to 15 years. This according to a report released today by the Population Division of the United Nations. The report, part of a World Population Survey for 1998, says AIDS has achieved pandemic proportions in several of 34 sub-Saharan countries where at least one in four people is infected with HIV. In Botswana, the hardest hit country in sub-Saharan Africa, life expectancy, which stood at 61 years only 5 years ago, has dropped to 47 and is expected to drop to 41 between 2000 and 2005. Former South African President F.W. de Klerk today won the first round in his battle to clear his name of apartheid violence allegations as the Truth Commission agreed to remove a section on him from its report. Truth Commission head Archbishop Desmond Tutu said in a statement, "We've instructed our printers to excise the contemplated finding on Mr. de Klerk from the copy of the report that will be handed to the president tomorrow." De Klerk's lawyers are to appear in Cape Town's High Court later today to seek an injunction preventing publication of the report with its findings that the man who freed Nelson Mandela knew of apartheid-era atrocities but hid his knowledge. Tutu said the decision to cut the findings on de Klerk had been taken reluctantly after the commission's lawyers had said they needed more time to prepare their case. This news from upstate New York in Amherst. When a sniper shot and killed Dr. Barnett Slepian 5 days ago at his home in the Buffalo suburb, operations halted in western New York's only remaining women's health clinic. But now, guarded by U.S. Marshals, the first of a dozen doctors will resume the clinic's operations, defying Friday's murder and 4 previous sniper attacks on abortion providers in the region and across the border in Canada. The shooting of Slepian, the 52-year-old obstetrician-gynecologist and father of 4 young sons, was the latest in a chain of strikingly similar shootings directed against doctors who perform abortions. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Bowing to pressure from his right-wing constituency, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced yesterday he would postpone the ratification of the new Palestinian-Israeli peace accord signed last week at the Y Plantation in Maryland until the Palestinians show the United States a plan to combat terrorism. As the Palestinian police announced yesterday, they had arrested a suspect for the killing of a Jewish settler shot near Hebron on Monday, a sign that the Palestinian security measures are in effect. Netanyahu blamed his delay in ratifying the agreement on Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's failure to submit a working security plan within the established deadline. Under the agreement yet to be ratified by Netanyahu's government, Israel agrees to withdraw from 13% of the West Bank in return for Palestinian measures to combat violence against Israelis. According to the Y agreements, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency is to play a role in carrying out the security measures and will act as an observer to ensure that both sides keep their promises. But what exactly did Yasser Arafat end up agreeing to? Many think Netanyahu wrestled Palestinians into an agreement that is far from quid pro quo and that promises no Israeli measures to combat anti-Palestinian violence. We're joined right now by Robert Fisk. He is the Beirut correspondent for The Independent of London. He joins us from Beirut. Welcome to Democracy Now! Robert, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you hear me? He's not able to hear us right now. We're going to try to get him on. Let's take a music break and we'll see if we can make contact with him. Well, we think we have made contact with Robert Fisk in Beirut, again voted by British editors the best foreign correspondent, has been in Beirut for 20 years. He joins us now from Beirut, a reporter for The Independent of London. Welcome to Democracy Now, Robert.
Thank you very much, Amy.
Oh, I'm glad you can hear me. Why don't you just tell us what you think of why agreements are that Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, and Yasser Arafat, Palestinian leader, have agreed to, and what the latest snag is in terms of Netanyahu?
Well, first of all, I don't think we'll be cut off again. I think that's probably my my very odd local phone line here. Look, first of all, I think that if you read through the text of the Y memorandum, you'll realize that this is little more than a restatement of the Oslo agreement of 5 years ago. What it basically says is, here are the things you didn't do which you should have done, please do them now, which is, in the eyes of the Arabs, and I think in the eyes of many Israelis as well, a pretty pathetic project, in the sense that if it hasn't been done so far, will it ever be done? The problem, I think, with why is really threefold. First of all, we have Mr. Clinton, as usual, saying, this is our show, this is an American show, this is something which the Americans are going to do, we've brought the people together at Y, we're going to get you to make the agreement. The Americans, therefore, appear, as they did at the time of Oslo, to be the people who are going to see this agreement through. But when you listen to what Mr. Clinton actually says, it's different. He says, we can bring the parties together, but it is for the parties themselves to make the hard decisions. In other words, America wants to take the credit for any success, but it won't guarantee and take responsibility for seeing through that this agreement is carried out by the Palestinians and the Israelis. So, number one, the Americans want to say this is our agreement, this is our treaty, but if it fails, it's not our fault. So when you have people who distrust each other so much, who suspect each other so much, as indeed the Israelis and Palestinians do, it's a very difficult situation when you say that and then say, well, we abnegate any responsibility for failure, which effectively is what President Clinton has done. I think secondly, and much more important, is that there is in this agreement a distinct ambivalence of words. What we have in the Y agreement is both sides signing up to a document which is strong on rhetoric. We want peace, we want peace. Everyone wants peace. I mean, if you could buy peace on a supermarket shelf, we'd all do that. But it doesn't talk about what this peace really involves. And so both parties, to use the American phrase, have gone back to their constituents. Yasser Arafat's gone back and is telling people in what he regards as Palestine as being, oh, well, you know, we're going to have a Palestinian state. This is another step on the road to a Palestinian state. And Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, was able to go back and at his press conference in Tel Aviv on his arrival from the United States said, this ensures there will not be a Palestinian state. So it allowed both Palestinians and Israelis to go back to their respective constituencies and say that the agreement ensures exactly the opposite of what the other person thinks. Indeed, we had Ariel Sharon, the Israeli foreign minister, saying the moment he arrived in Tel Aviv, well, the Israelis, according to the agreement, have to fulfill their side of the security guarantees before we make a withdrawal. Indeed, Y doesn't say anything of the kind. It doesn't say what the timing schedule is. But already the Israelis have decided in it. The Palestinians have to have to guarantee their obligations of security before we start a withdrawal. So even within 24 hours of the signing of this so-called historic agreement, the Israelis are stating things which are not in the agreement and which the Palestinians would not presumably agree with. The third, and I think in a way almost equally important, not quite, but almost equally important part of this, is that the agreement is very one-sided. The security guarantees, which have been set out very clearly, refer over and over again to terrorist cells, but they only refer to violent Arabs. There is no guarantee to protect the Palestinians from violent Israelis. On the West Bank now, in ever-enlarging settlements, we have right-wing Israelis, settlers, armed, they're not going to be disarmed like many of the Palestinians are going to be, who are the communities which gave us Baruch Goldstein, the man who massacred 29 Palestinians in the Hebron Mosque, who are not going to be touched by this security agreement. Under the terms of the Wire Agreement, if you actually read it, the CIA, of all people, that wonderful institution we all trust, is going to guarantee that the Palestinians arrest, quote, terrorists, unquote. But if a Palestinian is killed or murdered, there is no provision in the agreement for the Israelis or for the CIA to guarantee that the Israelis arrest the relevant people. Indeed, we've actually seen the play out of this scenario in the last 24 hours. A Jewish settler was murdered cruelly, wickedly, and immediately Arafat is called upon to arrest the Palestinian whom he thinks is responsible. But the Palestinian who's killed, there is no provision for the arrest of his murderer, whom it is generally assumed in the West Bank is probably an Israeli, and indeed there has been no such arrest. So it's a one-sided agreement, one in which Arafat has gone along through his usual weakness, and one which effectively allows both parties, I hate to keep using the American phrase, to interpret the agreement in their own way. So it is, to use a cliche, and I hate cliches in journalism, it's another recipe for disaster, another opportunity for Palestinians and Israelis to disagree rather than agree.
Robert Fisk, we only have a minute, but what does this latest news mean that whatever you think of the agreement that Netanyahu announced he's going to postpone ratification of it? And also, what does this mean for Palestinians on the ground, how they'll respond to Arafat?
Well, I can only I don't like agreeing always with James Rubin, the State Department spokesman, but he pointed out that the Palestinians do not, under the terms of the Wire Agreement, have only 7 days, as Mr. Netanyahu says, to provide the text of their own security agreement. There is a widespread belief in the Arab world, and among some Israelis, I should add, let's not get romantic about one side or the other, that Mr. Netanyahu yet again wishes to postpone any fulfillment of the Oslo Agreement on the grounds that he doesn't want it to be fulfilled. He doesn't want it to work. The French government, for example, privately is telling people that they think Mr. Netanyahu would like another war. He has, after all, a very warlike foreign secretary, Ariel Sharon. I think that Y has merely, for the Arabs at least, and I think for some considerable number of Israelis, merely confirmed their suspicion that the so-called peace process is dead and in the grave.
Well, Robert Fisk, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Robert Fisk is the Middle East correspondent for The Independent of London, based in Beirut. He has been there for more than 2 decades. Thanks for being with us. Coming up on Democracy Now!, we'll be looking at the elections coming up on Tuesday. We'll look at a clean money initiative that is being voted on in 2 states, Massachusetts and Arizona. And then we're going to talk with Dr. Yvonne Scruggs about the African-American vote. And we'll talk about issues she deems as head of the Black Leadership Forum must be addressed in this campaign. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Come together.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Today we're going to take a look at some ballot initiatives across the country that involve taking corporate money, taking private money out of campaigns. There are 2 such initiatives that are being voted on next Tuesday. Both, I believe, are favored to win. One in Arizona, and that is called Proposition 200, and the other in Massachusetts, which is Question 2, the Clean Elections Initiative. We're joined right now by representatives of both campaigns, as well as Ellen Miller, who's Executive Director of Public Campaign. Kaya Lenhart joins us from Phoenix. She's Political Director of Arizonans for Clean Elections. And David Donnelly is with us from Massachusetts. He's Campaign Manager of the Massachusetts Voters for Clean Elections. Ellen Miller, why don't you start off and tell us, what does the landscape in this country look like right now for clean money elections? And what exactly does that mean?
Well, let me lay out for you this sort of, try to summarize for you this sort of nationwide movement for clean money campaign reform. You know, campaign finance reform in Washington is stuck between a rock and a hard place. And in the face of that now increasingly partisan gridlock, state victories can help illustrate the fact that people really do care about the issue of money in politics and that they're willing to enact comprehensive reforms to really solve the problem. You know, the problem of big money in politics is not just a Washington problem. It's a problem that has affected, perhaps infected, every state capital around the country. And when citizens go to their legislators, whether they're federal legislators or state legislators, they meet with the same kinds of resistance. The resistance, you know, with the sound of cash registers in the back, in the background. So what's happening around the country is that state activists who are interested in federal reform but interested in their state reform because they've seen big money politics come to their states have really decided to take this issue into their own hands. And when citizens do that, well, you can't stop them. And that's what's happening, I think, most prominently right now in Massachusetts and in Arizona.
Well, let's go to Arizona, to Kaya Lenhart, who is Political Director of Arizonans for Clean Elections, speaking to us from Phoenix. Tell us what this ballot initiative in Arizona is all about, November 3rd.
Certainly. You know, I think perhaps more than just about any state in this country, Arizona has had a history of, you know, a continual cycle of corruption. And, you know, perhaps nowhere else is the prevalence of money in politics and the abuse has been so clear. And about 2 years ago, a number of concerned citizens and organizations got together to find, you know, a solution to this problem and to take special interest money out of politics. And the solution they came up with was the Clean Money Bill. And, you know, they tried to pursue this with the legislature, and the bill surprisingly didn't, or not too surprisingly, didn't even make it out of committee. So this group, which is perhaps one of the most broad-based coalition that's ever come together in the history of Arizona, including the League of Women Voters and the AARP and a number of other groups, then went to the ballot initiative and collected nearly 200,000 signatures this summer and placed this on the ballot this fall.
When you talk about corruption, you mean your former governor, for example, Fife Symington, being jailed for corruption?
Yes. Former Governor Fife Symington, former Governor Mecham, also impeached. And, you know, here, the ever-popular scandal of ASCAM, where legislators actually went and picked up bags of money in exchange for votes. You know, and even each day as you open up the newspaper here, you see, one more scandal. And it's not so much what's illegal, but it's what's legal and what has been accepted as business as usual here in Arizona. And, you know, people here are really tired of the corruption, and this bill is, you know, the first solution to this problem, as well as sending a message both here in Arizona to the legislature, but also nationally. You know, Arizonans tend to be a maverick state, and, you know, and this is very much an issue that they care about and want to send a message to the rest of the country as well.
Kaya Lenhart, what does Arizona's Proposition 200 actually say?
This initiative would reaches out to all levels of state government, both the, you know, from the state legislature up to the gubernatorial race, including attorney general and the secretary of state. And so for candidates who voluntarily accept the clean, you know, if they would like to participate in the system and give up special interest money, and can prove broad-based support within their legislative district, or if they're running in a statewide office, statewide support, received a fixed and equal amount of funding for their race.
But they have to opt into this.
Yes. We are under the same restraints as Massachusetts in that, you know, to comply with Buckley v. Valeo, a Supreme Court decision which says you cannot force somebody into this system. So it is voluntary. You choose to opt into the system.
Well, let's go to Massachusetts, to Boston, to David Donnelly, who's the campaign manager of Massachusetts Voters for Clean Elections. Can you tell us how the ballot initiative got on the Massachusetts ballot and what exactly that says?
Well, for years, Massachusetts activists have been documenting the problem of big money in the state legislature as well in statewide races, and have seen dramatic and disturbing problems in the funding of our elections. The largest category of donors to the state legislative candidates in this state are special interest lobbyists. People can only point at the problem so long before they want to go out and change it. So 3,500 volunteers last fall collected over 120,000 signatures. They went out again this spring after the legislature rejected our work and collected another 30,000 to gain ballot access. We have a broad coalition of organizations from AARP and Illegal Women Voters, just like in Arizona, as well as the entire Massachusetts congressional delegation, all 10 members of Congress, as well as our two U.S. senators who have signed on, 19 mayors from across the Commonwealth, mayors from both parties and independents, and 46 religious leaders who have added their voice of moral outrage against the system and in support of Question 2. We're working with 6,000 volunteers statewide right now at this point in the campaign, and we're working very hard to get a yes vote on Question 2 on Election Day. We're going to cover polls all over the state, and we're very excited about our chances.
What would be the caps on campaign spending, and who is it targeted at?
A yes vote on Question 2 lowers campaign spending and reduces the influence of special interest money in Massachusetts politics. It sets in place a new voluntary system where candidates who agree to strict spending limits from $30,000 for a state representative race to $3 million for a race for governor, those candidates who agree to those caps can receive a set amount of public money to run their campaign, but only after they qualify for it. Like Arizona, a candidate would have to demonstrate broad-based public support from their districts before receiving public money to run their campaign. The question, too, on the ballot also bans soft money from state politics and increases disclosure. It's a comprehensive solution to a problem that is growing every day. We need to have some dramatic steps to reduce the influence of all that money.
This does not include congressional or senatorial races?
No, that kind of reform will only come after enough states like Arizona, Massachusetts, Maine in 1996 and Vermont in 1997 enact their own reforms and start to train some heat on Washington. We need to demonstrate to Washington that far-reaching reform like these proposals are popular, are not just popular, but voters want them, and voters are going to enact them. Then we can come into Washington through activists working around the country. I think Ellen Miller at Public Campaign can give you more information about the progress around the country, but we certainly want to come to Washington with a whole lot more power and set our sights on reforming congressional elections.
And how close is it in Massachusetts right now?
The latest public opinion polls done by independent sources show a 54-28 spread on the yes side, a 2-1 support. Another poll will be coming out this week. We're working very hard. I mean, the only poll that we really care about right now is on Election Day, and we certainly hope that our good work and hard work over the last 2 years will pay off, and with a resounding yes vote, sending a message to Beacon Hill, our state capital, and also to Capitol Hill.
And Kaya Lenhart, in Arizona, what kind of support do you have for your Clean Elections initiative?
A recent independent poll here certainly buoyed our spirits in that we have a lead of 53% yes, 14% no, and 33% undecided. So at this point, we hold about a 4-1 lead.
We are talking to people around the country who are involved with clean money elections, pushing for campaign funding that takes it out of the private sector and makes it public. We're talking to David Donnelly, campaign manager of Massachusetts Voters for Clean Elections in Boston. Kaya Lenhart's with us from Phoenix, political director of Arizonans for Clean Elections. And in Washington, D.C., the mother of them all, Ellen Miller, executive director of Public Campaign. Ellen Miller, how do you deal with the criticism that this favors incumbents? Because if everyone is spending at the same amount, of course, the incumbent has more name recognition.
Well, it's just a false criticism, Amy. There is no system that favors incumbents more than the current campaign finance system. There was a report out yesterday by the Center for Responsive Politics that talks about this election in terms of federal campaigns as the least competitive in recent history. 60% of the House candidates have a financial advantage of at least 10 to 1 over their challengers. So no system could be less advantageous towards competition than the current one. This system, what it really does is it advantages these challengers who want to run for office, who don't have access to money, or who are not personally wealthy. And so the clean money, clean election system, what that really does is take this core concern of the public, the issue of competition. Good people can't run for office without access to money, and gives them a financial floor under them. There's no way to financially level the playing field with incumbents, but the clean money system goes further to ensure healthy competition with viable candidates than anything else that has ever existed.
You know, Amy, if I can jump in here and just say that we hear this claim a lot here in Massachusetts that this question, too, will help incumbents. Well, I guess the best barometer to find out whether it would help incumbents is whether incumbents would, you know, vote for it and pass it themselves to protect their own interest in getting reelection. And that certainly has not been the case in Massachusetts or Arizona or a number of states where legislation has been introduced. We need to work with incumbents to get them off the money trail. Many incumbents want to stop all this fundraising, but the leadership of our House here in Massachusetts is diametrically opposed to this. And they like to use these kinds of arguments, which sound nice, but in reality have no bearing in fact.
David Donnelly, you were involved in the Maine initiative and Vermont initiative as well. Is that right?
Yeah, the Vermont legislative campaign, yes.
How does the Massachusetts Clean Money, Clean Election initiative differ from those?
All these laws differ in a variety of different ways, the centerpiece of it being that candidates agree to overall spending limits, qualify for public money, receive that public money, and their fundraising is virtually over. That is in place in all the states that we're talking about here. The Massachusetts law includes a ban on soft money. The Maine initiative did not. The Massachusetts law does not include a matching component to match independent expenditures. The Maine law and those independent expenditures are money spent by outside groups geared towards impacting the outcome of the election that is not coordinated with the candidate. The Maine law does provide some leveling the playing field with outside money. There's a variety of different differences between all these proposals, but the equation is virtually the same on each one of these. Candidates agree to do something. They get something in return. Special interest money is blocked from influencing the people that we elect to serve on key issues of the day. That centerpiece is...
Amy, let me jump in here.
The Ellen Miller.
These proposals is the, in essence, elimination of private special interest funding of elections. It's a voluntary system. But candidates who opt in here agree to take very little in the case of Massachusetts or no private money, as is in the case of Arizona. The public hates the campaign finance system as it is right now. They hate their politicians being at the end of, in essence, a golden leash of special interest contributors, that they support this because they hate the current system because they see it as so corrupting and so unfair.
So what is the progress being made around congressional races, Ellen Miller, for Congress and for Senate in terms of limiting private money?
Well, very little progress is being made in Washington in terms of campaign finance reform at all. The reality is that reformers, all of us here who work here in Washington, have hit the brick wall on this issue. It has deadlocked into a partisan infighting. There was a majority of people in the United States Senate who wanted to address the two most egregious loopholes in the system. Let's put aside the core corruption, which is this day-to-day financing. But we couldn't even break through the Republican filibuster to end the soft money loophole, which is clearly was the most outrageous abuse of the 96 election. So the story becomes, you know, the states take the lead. States will show Washington how to proceed. And what's interesting is that state-level successes can encourage federal policymakers to become more courageous as advocates here in Washington for federal reform. The best case I can think of is the state of Maine passes a clean money system, a sweeping comprehensive system in 96, and suddenly Maine's two U.S. senators become advocates of reform in Washington. Now, this, I think, is another reason to move to the states, to allow states to experiment with these kinds of reforms.
And do you see the Wisconsin senatorial race between Mark Feinman and Russell Feingold as a referendum on campaign finance reform overall, since the campaign finance reform bill bears Feingold's name? I'm also wondering if a lot of anti-campaign finance reform forces are pouring money into Wisconsin to get Feingold out of office as senator.
Well, I do not see it as the Wisconsin race as a referenda on campaign finance reform per se. I do see it as an illustration of what's wrong with the current system. Both candidates have spent much too much time having to raise money for that race. On the Republican side, on Mark Newman's side, the Republican Party has poured in millions of dollars now into Wisconsin to advocate on his behalf and against Russ Feingold. Feingold has, you know, taken a courageous stand, some claim a really stupid stand, in not allowing the outside groups to come in and fund his campaign. It's not a referendum on reform, but it is an illustration of the nightmare of the current system.
If people are interested in introducing these initiatives in their states, how do they go about doing it?
Well, the public campaign itself serves as a resource center for many state groups and statewide coalitions working on this. We're now working with activists in over 40 states, as I think David mentioned earlier. And on the horizon, the Arizona initiative, the Massachusetts initiative, literally a week away. There are other states that are moving in this direction. We have a website, like everybody else, but on our website we have model pieces of legislation as well. And so people should go to that website, which is www.publiccampaign.org, or call us on our 800 number, which is actually 1-888-293-5755. That's 1-888-293-5755. There are lots of details up there about both the Massachusetts and Arizona campaigns, and you know what? It's never too late to get involved.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. If these two clean elections referenda get passed in Massachusetts and Arizona, how many will that mean have passed around the country?
Well, we would have four states then that have some aspect of the clean money system for either statewide offices or state and legislative campaigns. It will be a tremendous boost to the entire campaign finance reform community at the state level and at the federal level if we win these initiatives.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for joining us. Ellen Miller, Executive Director of Public Campaign based in Washington, D.C. David Donnelly, Campaign Manager of Massachusetts Voters for Clean Elections from Boston, and Kaya Lenhardt of Arizonans for Clean Elections. She's based in Phoenix, Arizona.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute to talk about race in the races. Stay with us.
We people who are dark up and blue, don't let us hang around this town and let what others say come true. We're just good for nothing, they all figure. A boy's grown up shiftless jitter. Now we can't hardly stand for that. Or is that really where it's at? we people who are darker than the blue. We got no time for segregating. Let's talk about brown and yellow too. Hi, yellow girl, can't you tell? You're just the surface of our dark deep well. If your mind...
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with our campaign coverage. Let's see, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, coordinating with the Congressional Black Caucus and various state parties, is committing nearly $1 million, three times more than it ever has in any given year, for a get-out-the-vote effort in black communities. About half the money will help finance an ad blitz on black and Hispanic radio. Also, black congressional members, from Congressmember John Conyers of Michigan to Maxine Waters of California, they're secure in their own districts. They're beginning a three-day bus tour, which is headed by Charlie Rangel, congressman from New York, through Chicago, Cincinnati, Louisville, Racine, Wisconsin, for an unprecedented effort to energize and motivate African-American voters. Jesse Jackson has been going around the country, got $200,000 from the Democratic National Committee for his efforts to get people out to vote. We're going to take a look at the African-American vote today. We're joined by our campaign correspondent, Bob Henley, and also by Dr. Yvonne Scrugg. She's executive director of the Black Leadership Forum, which is a consortium of civil rights and service organizations in the African-American community. She's also professor of power politics and diversity in George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dr. Scruggs. Why don't we start off by you telling us what the Black Leadership Forum is doing during this campaign season?
Well, clearly the key issue is getting people out to vote. And what the Black Leadership Forum is doing is focusing on a few community states, actually, where black voter participation has been lower than is healthy, and certainly lower than we'd like to see it, it be after so many years of focusing on voter registration. We now find that many people who are registered don't understand the importance of the off-year elections and stay home, and we think that's not to the advantage of the African-American community, and that we're nonpartisan, and we feel very strongly that both parties need to be reminded of the power of the political power and the poll power of African Americans, and the only way to do that is for people to go and express their interest by voting.
Why do you think it is that a black voter turnout typically lags between 4 and 6 percentage points behind whites when it comes to midterm elections?
Well, I think that you have to place that statement in the context of the general reduction in voter participation on the at the midterm election,
which is between 34% and 38%, I believe, historically.
Right, and the black vote is sort of consistently lower at midterm than it is in the presidential election. I think it, there are a number of contributing factors. I think that one certainly is that increasingly African Americans are being very skeptical and cynical about the role that their vote plays, in fact, in the life success of their issues in both parties, and that's clearly more difficult to overcome as a barrier to voting at midterms, when that's less glamorous and less national attention than it is at the presidential election. But in both elections, both the midterm and national general elections, we feel that black voter participation should be higher. And so we're working on that. And you asked me about issues, and, of course, I talked about voter participation as a major issue. But there are other issues, of course, which are driving our interest this time. And we can talk about those if you want to.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, we, of course, are concerned about education and the fight that this year, especially, fight in Congress about what was going to be passed and how important
improvement in the educational system and teachers and the quality of education and in the quality of the physical educational plants, how important that is to African Americans, and the fact that we got some of one and none of the other is certainly discouraging, and we think is very reflective of the inverted priorities in Congress in the last couple of year or so.
So actually, Doctor, you could juxtapose the dramatic increase in defense spending up against the reluctance of the Republican majority to spend any money, particularly on physical plant, I guess. Would you say that this is a concern to African Americans because primarily in urban areas are where we've experienced the lack or disinvestment in public education physical plant?
Absolutely, and it is in urban areas where the conservatives in Congress are pushing the notion of vouchers, and we find that to be particularly cynical because vouchers imply the ability to choose among options, and in urban areas there are virtually no options. The public schools are in disrepair, and there are very few private schools that would be attractive to voucher spenders. And so when we look at the continued or the persistence of Congress in not increasing the quality of the physical plant, we think that that's by design.
Let me ask you also, with some concern, I guess 100 HMOs have walked away from their Medicaid obligations, and I understand that at this point we have more Americans uninsured than we did 4 years ago. Is that something that looms large on
your
agenda?
It certainly is. Let me just quickly run down the list of the issues that we have on our major flyer, which says lift every voice and vote. And these are the issues that we feel are critical to the African-American community: education, quality health care, both the disinvestment of the HMOs and the increase in HIV/AIDS rates and cancer and diabetes, drugs, and the disproportionate sentencing policies that have a negative effect on African-American youth, jobs in the economy, this whole discussion about welfare reform and about how so many people are off welfare, and yet we know that most of them have gone into temporary jobs. Most of these new independent non-welfare workers are making less money than they were making, and that they're going to be eventually much worse off unless we do something about job development. Civil rights and affirmative action. We're looking at what's happening in Washington, the state of Washington, with this cynical civil rights bill, which is exactly like the one that passed in California, which has had such a devastating effect on black enrollment, particularly in graduate schools.
On that one, Dr. Scruggs, the Washington State Initiative, this is an initiative to get rid of affirmative action, but not exactly being framed that way?
No, it's being framed. It's, as a matter of fact, called the Civil Rights Initiative, and it is using the code words of preferences and quotas to deceive Americans, white Americans, who would otherwise be very interested and supportive of affirmative action, which is equal access, equal opportunity. And this initiative is being funded by the same forces that funded the initiative in California, 209, which eliminated the consideration of race for almost all kinds of interaction between minority communities and the public, for school admissions, for jobs, for contracts. And in the state of Washington, a similar initiative with almost identical language seeks to do the same thing, to make it impossible for women and for minorities to have the kind of equal access that affirmative action has always provided. And it's distorting the interpretation by saying, well, it's really preferences. It's not affirmative action. And that's of deep concern to both the African-American community and Hispanic and Asian communities, as well as women.
Well, Doctor, isn't there also a concern at the state level? There's a number of gubernatorial contests that are, I would imagine, would be very important, particularly South Carolina, Illinois, Florida, major races where if you put together the Latino and African-American voting strength, there's considerable leverage there. Are you concerned that may go underutilized?
Well, yes, but, you know, one of the things, one of the constraints under which the Black Leadership Forum constantly works is that we are a 501c3 not-for-profit organization, and as such, we have to be very clear that we do not take partisan positions, and so we're not for one candidate or against another candidate so much as we are absolutely unequivocally in support of African Americans and other disenfranchised groups having the opportunity to express their choices, taking the opportunity to express their choices and doing so in safety. And in some of these states that you mentioned, South Carolina particularly, we have, and North Carolina, where it's not, the gubernatorial race is not so critical, but there are other races, there is now voter intimidation going on. And we are paying a great deal of attention to the tools and strategies that are now being used to keep African Americans from voting. For example, when they went to the polls in some of these locations for the primaries, when they were asked for identification, and there are many different kinds of identification you can show, including your most recent telephone bill, they were told if they didn't have a driver's license, they didn't have legitimate identification, and they couldn't vote. So we're concerned at the state and local level that the enfranchisement of the vote is not abrogated by illegal behavior. There's all kind of stuff going
on. So what you're saying is all the work and sacrifice over the last 20 years has to be redeemed with each election.
With each election, and that's what's so frustrating, I think, and very discouraging to many of us in the civil rights movement. I think we made the mistake in 64 and 65 with the civil rights law and the voting rights law of assuming that we were then on the path to equity and justice, and all we had to do was reach out and bring people from the suppressed and depressed communities onto this path. We are finding now, what is this, almost 40 years later, that there are those who would just as soon reverse the gains of the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act, and that indeed they have developed new and sophisticated ways of doing just that. We don't have a poll tax, but we do have poll watchers who will divert voters in some of these communities, particularly in the Deep South, if they get the chance. And that means that you have to be ever vigilant. You have to be ever educating people to what their rights really are.
We're talking to Dr. Yvonne Scruggs. She is Executive Director of the Black Leadership Forum. Also joining us, Democracy Now! Campaign correspondent Bob Henley. As we talk about race and the races around this country, the Black Leadership Forum has a campaign to get voter turnout up, and it's called Lift Every Voice and Vote. What about the areas of the country that you say, Dr. Scruggs, that you're focusing on? Which particular races are you pushing for African Americans to get out and vote next Tuesday?
As we look at the states where voter participation has been low, we are working in very close collaboration with the Operation Big Vote. People know that as the familiar name is National Coalition for Black Voter Participation. And this is a 22-year-old organization that focuses only on election education and political participation. And we have together identified a number of states where we feel that black voting could be increased if people focused on the issues that are at stake, had some conversations with people whom they respect and trust about how these issues affect them in their local communities. You know, nobody lives at the national level. We all live in local communities, and people need to understand the importance of health care and the availability of health care in their local communities. And so we're looking in the states of Alabama and California and Florida and Georgia and Illinois and Indiana and Kentucky and other states, North Carolina, South Carolina, at the voter participation, hoping that through this grassroots education process, people will recognize that this may not be a presidential election year, but every election is critical to the maintenance of their status as civic participants, and that they need to get out and vote. And Operation Big Vote and the Black Leadership Forum are making every effort to communicate this through our local affiliates.
Dr. Scruggs, there seems to be an ever-increasing amount of campaign money being spent. We're now approaching $1 billion. What could you say to the average voter who might feel disempowered, who feels that if they can't bring money to the table, that they're really marginalized?
Well, I'll tell you the story that Dr. Joseph Lowery, who's the chairman of the BLF, was telling the other day at a national press conference we held, that in one of the communities in Georgia where he lives, there is an election from the primaries that is still in recount. And the first count, there were the candidate lost by 8 votes, and with the recount, the candidate lost by only 2 votes. And then he found out that his brother, his mother, and his son had failed to vote.
Oh,
I mean, this is a true story. And there are many instances. You know, we get all the news at the national level, and we get this feeling of great power and that these balkanized groups. But in fact, it's all played out in the precincts and the neighborhoods in communities. And there are so many stories of where a candidate wins by only a few votes, and those votes represent the individual acts of people. And we try to make this point that there is no monolith here as far as voting is concerned. Everything is the accumulation of single, isolated choices and acts to express those choices. And it's very hard to get that notion across when people sort of see on the 7 o'clock news the global nature of the decision process. But the fact of the matter is their vote is the fundamental foundation on which our democracy is built, and they need to claim that power.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. We have been talking with Dr. Yvonne Scruggs, Executive Director of the Black Leadership Forum. And if you want to get in touch with them, where can people call or go on the web?
The phone number is 202-789-3506. And right now we have an email address, which is blfinc@gte.net.
One more time.
blfinc@gte.net.
That's BLF for Black Leadership Forum, INC.
Or Incorporated.
Incorporated at gte.net. And again, the phone number,
202-789-3506.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and Bob, we won't give out your home number, but Dr. Yvonne Scruggs, thanks for being with us, and thanks very much, Bob Henley, Democracy Now! Campaign correspondent. Thank you.
Both of you have a good day.
Bye. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Our email address is democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and Jeremy Scahill. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Julie Drizin is our executive producer, Michelle Garcia, our webmeister. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!